This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Clearly you've been briefed about this podcast. Apparently it is a real bad egg. I mean, if you look at it, you'll see it for yourself. We're talking about disobedience, stealing, spitting, running away, throwing rocks, throwing stuff, defacing stuff, burning stuff, loitering, and graffiti. And that's just the stuff we know about. Welcome to the Art House Legends Podcast. This is the Movie Dude, Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and you don't understand. If I don't record another podcast, they send me to juvie.
And this is Chris, and I didn't choose the Skux Life. The Skux Life chose me.
And this episode, we're discussing Hunt for the Wilder People, starring Sam Neill, Julian Dennison, Rima Tiwaita, Rachel House, Oscar Keitley, and directed by Taika Waititi. You know, it seems just like yesterday or last year that we were talking about a certain New Zealand director who was known for making these very oddball type movies. Do you remember that, Kent, just a little bit?
I remember a very strange documentary that wasn't a documentary, but it's like the last line of that documentary made me forget it, so I have to watch it again and again, and it just keeps wiping my memory again. So something supernatural about dressing up as vampires and running.
especially that most vampiric of places, Wellington, New Zealand. Yeah.
The last place you'd ever look.
And I remember very clearly how I was shamed by three individuals during that particular podcast because I just didn't give it the love that I felt was unwarranted to it. Hmm. Are you still shaming me?
Actually, I thought you liked it. You sure my memory hasn't been tampered with? I know myself and guest Lauren were shaming all who did not love it as the greatest movie of the year.
And there was one individual who didn't, and it wasn't Lobster.
Mm, he maybe.
But out of curiosity,
which
Chris.
Which is bad.
That's true. Okay. But Chris, what is your opinion on What We Do in the Shadows?
Oh, I love What We Do in the Shadows. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. You can go back to that episode and hear what I had to say about it. I didn't hate it. Understand, I didn't hate it, but I wasn't impressed.
Right, yeah,
but,
I gotcha.
Yeah, but again, you can go to that episode and listen to it. It was part of our Art House of Horror of 2016, and you can tell me how you believe that I'm right, because I am right about that movie. But out of curiosity, Chris, are you familiar with any of Taika Waititi's other work?
I went back and looked at everything. And I mean, I've heard of Eagle vs. Shark, but I haven't seen it. And I want to see Boy, because I haven't seen that either. But I've mostly just seen What We Do in the Shadows, Hunt for the Wilder People, and movie came out today, Thor Ragnarok. That's all I've seen.
All right, so have you seen this movie prior to this podcast?
I watched it once last year.
Yeah. And did it leave a specific impression on you at that particular point? What was your frame of reference before coming into it for this episode?
I think the way I felt about Hunt for the Wilder People is how you feel about What We Do in the Shadows. First time around.
I see.
So, yeah.
Okay. But what about you, Kent? Were you aware of this movie prior to seeing it for this episode? I remember that I don't think you saw it after What We Do in the Shadows, or before What We Do in the Shadows.
No, I hadn't seen it, and I just seen the trailer for it, and actually just kind of had it in mind after I saw the trailer for it. That's like, you know, we need to watch this some point and do a review of it without even seeing it. It's like, let's put it on the schedule, gonna watch it. Mm-hmm. Not sure when. but got on the schedule, decided, yeah, he's directing a certain other movie. Yeah, so.
Okay, so I was aware of Hunt for the Wilder People prior to when we did What We Do in the Shadows. I didn't see it primarily because I really couldn't find a good opportunity to see the film. And on top of that, I was so unimpressed with What We Do in the Shadows. It's not a big priority. Now, I will say, though, that at some point after we did that episode, I did watch a scene of the film, and it's one of the more hilarious and daring scenes in the film. And when I saw this, like, okay, I'm gonna have to at some point watch this movie because it is very interesting. On top of that, I didn't realize that Sam Neill was in it, and I'm a serious Sam Neill fan, so.
As he should be, so, because he's amazing. Yeah.
And I mean, I didn't give him like all the love in the world when we did Jurassic Park, but it's just because Sam Neill is one of those guys that he can lead a movie, but I think that when you give him an opportunity to be a character, to really get himself involved in a character, and he gets lost in the character, that's when he really shines. You know, I go back to thinking about Hunt for Red October. I think about Dead Calm. You know, I look, you know, whenever he's a part of an ensemble, I will admit that I have a certain love for Event Horizon that probably some people would find really annoying. I fucking love that movie. Sorry, I'm not going to be unashamed. I'm not going to be shamed by my love for Event Horizon because, you know, it's just like how Michael Bay actually made a good movie with The Rock. I think Paul W.S. Anderson did actually do a really good job with Event Horizon, and he should be applauded for it. Although it just makes watching his Resident Evil movies even more painful, knowing that he is capable of doing something good if given, you know, I guess maybe a lot of drugs. I don't know. But let's go ahead and let's talk about this movie. So, I have to admit, even with seeing that one scene of Hunt for the Wilder People, I didn't realize what kind of movie I'd be getting into, especially with a title like this, and especially with the concept behind this movie. I honestly thought that we're just getting basically a live-action remake of Up, the Pixar movie.
Yeah.
I mean, was this the same? Oh, really? It's like a cranky old man, a young boy out in the wilderness being hunted by other craggly individuals with dogs, or that dogs were involved, seeking a bird that no one that is believed to be extinct or never to have existed, that didn't come up at all.
See, I didn't even think of it while I was watching the movie. I was, like, reading the IMDb stuff and saw that and was like, holy shit, that is so true. But it doesn't make the movie any less awesome, so, you know, it doesn't bother me.
All right, well, we'll be getting into it. But what about you, Ken? Did you have
It never flashed on me about that. It never came to mind, so it was more... Well, Up was more old man and kid go on adventure and end up going head to head against evil villain with intelligent dogs. This felt more like just a chase through wilderness. Like, more like a, well, I mean, it is a, outdoor adventure of them running into crazy people while they get chased. They're not up against, they're trying just to be by themselves.
I'm actually going to give you another synopsis of the exact same film, but I'm wondering if either one of you can tell which movie I might be talking about here.
Okay.
Two crazy individuals being chased by law enforcement and vigilantes even crazier than they are in a highly stylized and absurd look at the pop culture media that infest the national landscape of a particular film. Am I talking about Hunt for the Wilder People or Natural Born Killers?
You talked about Natural Born Killers, but because I was about
wrong.
To
I'm talking
that.
About both of them.
Okay, yeah.
The only difference is that
I almost said Thelma and Louise, but when you talked about
that. I actually, believe it or not, you could also say Thelma and Louise as well on that, too.
Yeah.
Or other movies. Bonnie and Clyde, maybe. Badlands might come to mind. If you want to go
Coach
with
Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
A Man and a Kid, you could probably talk about A Perfect World with Kevin Costner and Clint Eastwood. This could be seen as just kind of a trope. Maybe just a tiny bit like a trope, right? But let's get deeper into this, because first off, we do have Taika Waititi, which we know is kind of a highly stylized director, especially if you look at his other work. We're specifically going to be comparing this to What We Do in the Shadows, because I think that's the only one that all three of us have seen up to this point, although I have a strange feeling that a certain Marvel movie will also be a point of reference given a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But
it will be.
But one thing that Taika Waititi is really good at, and even with What We Do in the Shadows, that I will give him credit for, is on a very small budget, he is capable of giving you a movie that feels a lot more epic than his budget would normally allow for, right? And a lot of that is by building characters and building the scenario and the situation to a point where it has kind of an epic feel. But do you get that with this?
It feels like, well, all of the outdoor sets could have been done under very restrictive conditions and therefore have been cheaper to film, yet it does feel like he's playing a huge area,
mm-hmm.
which would be normally super expensive.
What about you, Chris? What do you get from the way that the film sets up the epicness of its story and of its setting?
I mean, it feels a lot bigger than it probably is. And I mean, I don't know what the budget is on it offhand. I didn't look it up, but I'm sure it's probably pretty small. But I mean, he does accomplish a lot with a small budget. So
mm-hmm.
kudos to that, you know.
But what do we think about kind of how this movie sets up its main characters within that particular first scene where we have how do I put this? It's not just that we have the main characters, but kind of the way that the film opens with kind of a chapter break, a chapter one, giving us a sense of that this is a storybook movie, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in fact, as I was watching it for the one and a half time that I saw this, I have to admit there's an element to this movie. Like, if you were to write this out, this would be kind of a Newbery Award young adult fiction novel, right? I mean,
it feels like a kid's book, but the kind that would get almost banned because, oh no, it's showing rebellion and oh, horrible.
Oh, I don't know. Just part of me, just like, I feel like if you were to see this in a novel form, it would have the Newbery Award sticker right next to it. You know,
it
feels like something that you would have, you know, 13-year-olds read in, you know, an English class a little bit, although a lot more funnier than most of those. But, I mean, just the way that the situation is set up, I mean, you have yourself a troubled young boy who is being sent out to the middle of nowhere. I mean, hell, that in itself, I think, has been made into young adult novels for God knows how long. I mean, you could probably, I mean, hell, even Twilight, for crying out loud, is basically the scenario, right?
Yes.
Just saying. I mean, I'm not saying that it's a great comparison, but you can make that comparison, right? Just saying. I will say that this is a better romance than Twilight. But, well, maybe I shouldn't be saying that considering. Yeah.
He's a non-molester. Come on, man.
Okay,
we'll get into that. But I do love the fact that the first chapter sets up everything. It sets up the character dynamics. It sets up the situation. And it does so very slowly, very methodically. And it sets up the three main characters. Ricky, our young boy, in kind of his situation, Bella, who is the adoptive mother and kind of the one that's really driving the spirit of this movie, even long after she dies, it's really her ghost is kind of in the scenes that we don't see her in. And Heck, who is kind of the reluctant guardian, right? I mean, it sets up this dynamic extremely well. And what really surprised me was basically 15 minutes of movie. About 15 to 20 yeah. minutes is just on this chapter. But what about this first chapter really impressed you, or that left an impression on you, whether it was a good or bad impression?
Well, the family he's left with is definitely something he hasn't encountered before. I mean, Bella gleefully chops up an animal right in front of him. And that, like, completely horrifies him. I thought that was funny. And then during director's commentary, no animals were harmed during the making of this film.
Of course. But, yeah. Like, one thing that I think is really impressive is how they set up Bella. Because yeah. Bella is really the main character of the first chapter. Ricky is going to be our main protagonist throughout the film. But Bella is the character that is going to resonate throughout the rest of the film when she's not even in it. Because she's the one who shows Ricky love, and possibly even the first love that he's ever felt in his life. She's the one who sticks by him even when he is trying to run away. She's the one who trusts him with a gun and shows him how to shoot. She's the one who shows him the life that, you know, that they have out in this countryside. And to the point where at the beginning he hates it, and through her he has a newfound respect for it, right? And part of it is because of the fact that she went crazy on that pig, right?
Yeah.
I mean, say what you will about, you know, how horrific it was that she slaughtered this thing and the blood all over her face. But I think the thing that really sells it is that she's smiling and still sweet even after, you know, quickly killing this creature. You know, it's not psychotic. This is just what we do here, right?
Yeah, it's not like there's any enjoyment in it. It's just like, you know, a source for food.
Yeah, she's not sadistic. And we don't ever get a sense of sadism or menace about her. She loves so wholeheartedly. And especially considering how she, you know, she shows that love, and how not just for Ricky, or I love kind of how the film says it, Ricky, you know, but also Heck. I mean, you know, Heck is a pretty tough character to love, right? I mean, he's gruffy, he's grumbly, he mumbles and grumbles, and when he does have something to say, it's usually not something nice. Right,
that's what makes him lovable.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, he just happened to be a former dinosaur, you know, a dinosaur hunter who, you know, may have
retired to New Zealand.
He never got over his dislike of kids. Went out and became a hermit into the New Zealand bush. Right.
Yeah.
Just saying, but. What about you, Chris? What do you kind of get from this character dynamic?
I don't know if anything else to add. I think you guys covered everything that I could think of.
It's almost a setup to do a good cop bad cop, Ricky.
Well, so I mean,
it's very nice, nurturing, and then ready to be gruff and force things. But then at the same time, Bella's freaks out Ricky with, oh, hey, I'm just doing dinner. Chop, 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 chop.
Well, here's the question I would have, though. Who is actually worse to Ricky, Heck or Paula the social worker?
Oh, Paula's horrible.
Paula, hands down. Fuck that lady.
Just listen to how she talks to him right from the get-go. I mean, she's, you know, she basically makes him out to be a criminal. She, you know, she seems, it's like she's handing Bella, Ricky off to Bella, but she's like, oh, no returns, and, you know, and kind of making these kind of really nasty jokes. All of her jokes are mean-spirited. I mean, Bella will say some, maybe not some politically correct nice things to Ricky. You know, she might make a mention
fat
about
jokes.
His weight, but she isn't mean to him. You know, she isn't cruel to him. She's, you know, she seems to love him despite the things about him that may or may not be very pleasant. Or that's kind of the way that she sets it up, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, though, Paula does have a kind of a counterbalance to herself, which is Officer Andy. What do you think about the dynamic between Paula and Andy as characters, considering that they're pretty much side by side through the majority of the film, right?
Normally if we see Paula, we see Andy right there. Mm-hmm. But at some point, Paula just kind of ticks over and...
But
things are going to get out of control by chapter 3.
Is Andy her minion, or is he kind of an affable fool? What is his role specifically through the majority of the film? We'll talk about the ending in a little bit. But what role does he play in relation to Paula?
Isn't he more of like a sidekick, basically? So I kind of looked at him. She was like overbearing and fucking like, you know, overprotective and shit. And he's all laid back about it, sitting there eating trail mix, just kind of making side remarks.
Well,
that were
what
awesome.
Do you mean by overprotective, though?
She's like, she's worried about Ricky, but it doesn't seem like she's worried about his well-being. She's more worried about her reputation, about no child being left behind or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I don't see it being about being protective. I think it's more kind of like she has herself a Tommy Lee Jones fetish a little bit, you know. I always get my man, you know. Didn't you get a sense of the fugitive with her? Like, she's like living out her John Walsh fantasies a little bit about being on the hunt when going after Heck and Ricky. You know, it seems like this is her chance to live out her fantasy of getting out in the wilderness and you know, capturing the fugitive.
It's a manhunt, and wow, she's leading the manhunt somehow. So,
well, yeah, I think it's interesting that I don't know if she's really leading it or if she's just got herself kind of as the figurehead for this. It's not like we see her ordering the SWAT teams around, which, by the way, SWAT teams?
Yeah.
Really? Okay, but I guess before we get into the SWAT team aspect, we kind of have to explain how we get to this part.
Yeah.
Because Bella dies just after Ricky has accepted that this is his life, and it's after his 13th birthday, right? He has a birthday. We have the really kind of weird, goofy, odd birthday song. That Bella sings.
It was amazing, improvised, and awesome.
I'm not gonna say it's a bad song. I'm not gonna do that. Although seeing Sam Neill's response to the song was priceless. Like, he just didn't know what was gonna happen, and he was just like, that wasn't a character, that was the actor. Like, what the hell am I watching here?
Yes.
But at the same time, it also kind of, I'll be honest here, like one of my big problems with what we do in the shadows is I felt like it needed to have music in it. And, well, let's be honest here, The Hunt for the Wilder People has music. It has a lot of music. Not like drowning in music, but it definitely had enough music that you can enjoy. And I love the fact that it has that kind of Flight of the Conchords kind of spontaneity, so to say. I mean, it's not as polished as Flight of the Conchords, obviously, but it is pretty spontaneous, I guess, is the best way to put it, right? Or have either of you seen Flight of the Conchords?
I haven't seen it.
I've seen enough to know what you're referencing, so yeah.
Yeah.
And it should be said that Taika Waititi was involved with that in his collaborations with Jermaine Clement, who was part of Flight of the Conchords, kind of would show, you know, would show through in this particular film. A lot of the elements that I think made that show famous is the stuff that we're seeing here, kind of the sense of loving parody being put, a lot of comedy tropes thrown in, not just for the joke, but just as kind of a tone setter, so to say. This movie is drenching with tone. Taika Waititi, I don't think his storytelling isn't tight, but what I think he does here is that he makes sure that you get the good vibes off this. At no point are you thinking that this is going to turn into a dark, sinister kind of thriller, right? Even though there's a lot of heavy things that are happening. Did y'all ever get a sense of that this could end in tragedy?
Oh yeah,
you did get that.
I got sense something bad could happen, probably to Heck, but yeah.
Huh. Hmm. Well, that's interesting.
But you know, it's.
Would the film deal with something bad happening to the characters as melancholic or depressed? Do you think that this movie would end on a downer note, or do you think it would end on a more positive, upbeat note?
It would make light of it. After Bella dies at her funeral, Taika Waititi has an awesome cameo role as the fucking minister.
Oh, I love Taika Waititi's
me too
minister.
So if anything else had happened, it would be something like that to take the edge off and still be, you know, light and easy to process, you know.
Yeah. So. And I'm just gonna say that if for every dark, sinister thing that does happen in the movie, they usually follow that up with a joke or with something to kind of lighten the tone. It never gets to a point where you're feeling doom and gloom. And understand that on the surface, this could have been a very dark and depressing movie. Mm-hmm. You know, after Bella's death, after Ricky, you know, runs away from the home when he realizes that he's going to be sent back into the system, and obviously after the misunderstanding regarding Ricky and Heck and the Hunters, to the point where there is a manhunt. They think that Heck is a sexual pervert and a kidnapper. And in a way, they're kind of both running away from reality. In a way, you could see this. Again, I mentioned, you know, Badlands. I mentioned Natural Born Killers, Bonnie and Clyde. All of those, you can kind of see the same vibe, which is basically the modern life, modern society, and reality is hunting these characters down and wants to break them. Now, in those movies, those characters were bad or anti-heroes at the very least. So if reality were to break them, we wouldn't feel too bad. Whereas with these two characters, as much as Heck gives Ricky a bad time, he isn't absolutely horrible to him, right? He doesn't do anything that we would deem to be unforgivable, right? Or is there anything that he does do that you find yourself going, fuck this guy?
I think he always has the best intentions despite his demeanor of like being kind of standoffish and crotchety.
Yeah. That's really his only sin, crotchety.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he expected to be... I think he half expected Bella to be doing most of the taking care of Ricky, and with her gone, then it's like, okay, I'll do what she wanted.
Well, he even calls it out. Bella was the one that adopted Ricky, not Heck.
Yeah.
And while he did marry Bella, one thing an exposition dump like this could feel really out of place, but when Heck kind of has his own eulogy for Bella.
Yeah.
You know, and he puts it, it's like, no, she wanted to, she finds, you know, wretched dogs like you and me, and she wants to fix us. And we can kind of see it. We can definitely see how Ricky and Heck are kind of more alike than we probably saw at the beginning. You know, they both are outcasts. They don't fit in with the modern world. One escapes through bad behavior. The other one literally escapes into the wilderness. And I think part of me would have liked to, in the movie, for there to be more scenes of Heck and Ricky bonding, in some fashion or form, through their, escape into the wilderness. But at the same time, though, I don't know if Heck is capable of being fatherly to Ricky. I think that even he kind of realizes that he really can't do this, and that Ricky is doing most of the work bonding with Heck, right?
Yeah.
So I guess my next question is, what does Ricky kind of see in Heck, considering that the likenesses between the two aren't overtly apparent? You have to really kind of think about it. So what is it that Ricky kind of clings to Heck for?
Being an adult figure that knows what the heck he's doing. I think Ricky recognizes Heck knows what he's doing. Except for reading.
What about you, Chris?
I'm not sure if he sees him as a father figure. I mean, I guess he does.
Well, I mean, at the end of the film, he'll require that Heck accept him calling him uncle, as a condition for their next adventure, right?
Right, yeah.
So that wouldn't mean that would require a familial bonding between the two.
Hmm. But what do you think? Maybe as a provider? I mean, I'm not sure. Not really sure.
We do see Heck does find him when he gets lost. He does feed him on that night with the slug. So there are those things to him. But is that something that Ricky would kind of cling on to? Or is there something else?
I'm not sure.
All right.
Well, there's no place for him to run to either.
Well, that is true.
Before they run, there's no place for him to go. So.
Well, I mean, the thing is that there's one or two options. Either he goes into society at any point, any part of society, he'll be collected and he'll be either sent to another home that he'll absolutely fail in, or he'll be sent to juvie. And he understands that. He understands that his behavior has had repercussions that are going to ensure him that his life is one of going in and out of prison. So there is the aspect of escape that Heck definitely envisions. The fact that, he does come from the wilderness. He does live in the wilderness. Ricky sees him as kind of an outlaw. I mean, at certain points, he even calls him straight up gangster, and especially considering how Ricky idolizes gangsters and gangster culture. I mean, hell, he calls his dog Tupac, and let's be honest here, Ricky's not exactly someone who understands the street in that sense. I doubt that the New Zealand version of a hood would have anything on South Central, you know what I'm saying? So he's idolizing kind of this romantic version of gangsta life, which also kind of could be seen about the romanticization of being someone that's outside of the, a wild man or someone that's, someone that lives out in nature, right? I mean, we had a movie not too long ago called Into the Wild where we had, a boy kind of go out into the Alaska wilderness and find out it wasn't exactly as awesome as he had envisioned it, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's comparisons that can be made between that and that what Sam Neill's character is, and the fact that they get Sam Neill, who definitely, even though he looks a little heavier, a lot more scruffier, and wearing really baggy clothing, still kind of has a sense of a strong male figure in him, a masculine characteristic towards himself, right? Something that Ricky could see as a leading figure in his life. Do we kind of see that?
Yeah, yeah.
And also, do you find it interesting that the main antagonist regarding Heck and Ricky is, in fact, a woman, that Paula is the face of the forces that are trying to wrangle them, that are trying, that intends to muzzle them. She's intending to take Ricky back into prison or into the home, and she wants Heck to go to jail. This is what she's aiming for. And the fact that she's leading male forces to take these two men in, or this man and this boy in, do you kind of see that there might be a sense of a battle of the sexes aspect of the film?
Well, she's the governed. She's the face of the man. Mm-hmm. Part could have been played by a guy, but I don't think it would have been quite as fun. And see, but her kind of breakdowns.
I love the fact that when Paula is comparing the situation to the Terminator, she sees herself as the Terminator and Ricky as Sarah Connor.
Yeah.
You know. Before the chin-ups. Yeah.
Before the chin-ups, yes.
It's chin-ups.
But, I mean, if you look at it, though, at the same time, she really isn't too far off. By that particular point, Ricky is kind of the Sarah Connor before the chimps. And by the end of it, considering that, he goes straight up gangster killing pigs, jumping out in front and killing pigs and willing to shoot heck in the ass. I can say that he transforms to the Terminator to Sarah Connor a little bit. He does pull a gun on heck with the intentions is like, if you go to the cops, I'm going to shoot you. I mean, that's... that would be something that Sarah Connor would do in Terminator 2, right? I mean, basically straight up murder a man in front of his kid to save the future. I mean, am I a little too off on that? Is there a comparison can be made here?
Well, this may be stretching, but he has grown up a little, so he definitely does not want to go back to juvie.
That's true.
Well, go to juvie, because he's never actually been to juvie.
Yeah, he's just bounced from home to home.
But he knows that he's eventually going to show up there. And that scares
him. Well, I think he was happy, though, in that environment, thinking, I can't really get in trouble. I'm not going to go to juvie because there's nothing to do out here. So he was content.
Well, he was doing shit. But the thing was, Bella was willing to...
deal with it.
Yeah, she was willing to, kind of, accept what he does and kind of like, you're not getting out of this that easy. But at the same time, if you want to run, sure, you can run. But I also love the fact that where is he going to run to?
Yeah.
And when he comes to that realization, I love that he doesn't have that like flashlight moment like, oh, I see. But he kind of slowly comes to accept Bella and accept Heck and accept the situation. And by the time that he fully embraces Bella and sees her as a figure of love, that moment she dies and he's stuck with Heck. And at that particular point, this is a boy who's accepted love and he has no place really to give it but to this cranky old man and who really isn't interested in that love. And then, of course, you have your situation where, they're kind of out in the bush. And then they come across these three hunters. And this is where the shit gets real, right? to quote the movie a little bit. Right? I mean, first off, the scene of the hunters, this was the scene that I saw that made me say, okay, you know what? I got to see this movie because this is funny, dark, and genuinely fucked up, right? This is like, what the hell was Ricky thinking when he put it the way that he did? And I love the fact that he does kind of call it out and that Ricky does realize too late what he said. I do love that. But what do you take about this scene and especially how Heck handles himself? This is the first time that we see Heck, kind of do something proactive, right? Or it's reactive in a sense, but it's also proactive, right? He realizes what the hunters are going to do and he kicks their ass. Like, with a broken leg and everything, he just handles them.
Well, to an extent, he starts getting his ass kicked because of the numbers game. So,
it's a 3-on-1 fight, or I guess a 3-on-1.5.
Yeah,
and and Ricky does get involved at points, but Heck, for the most part, is taking the beating and giving it like it's nobody's business. He dismantles their guns. He make sure that they can't follow him. And, ultimately he helps Ricky to elude capture in New Zealand, which we should remember is an island, for the better part of almost 6 months during winter. Well,
it is a fairly big place, so.
Well, so. I mean, this is the place that gave us Lord of the Rings. So yes, we do have to put it that way. Although I do like the fact that at no point does Taika Waititi use any elements that look Lord of the Rings-ish.
Yeah.
We don't get any kind of the scooping landscapes with the visual flair that's Lord of the Rings. I mean, there's a couple of, like with the car chase at the end, we do use, you know, like roaming camera shots and stuff like that. You know, aerial footage and things that could be the closest to Lord of the Rings, but I think that wasn't meant to kind of give that impression more than it was that it was just trying to show these characters on the move, right?
Mm-hmm. It strikes me his style is more ground-based. Keep the camera on the ground with the characters.
Not really. So, I mean, yeah. he does use a lot of aerial shots. He does.
Yeah.
But again, the thing is that he's trying to get the impression these characters are in the wilderness. They can get lost for months. They could find a way to disappear while the cops are on their heels. You know, they with Heck basically saying, well, these guys don't know the bush. You know, that's kind of a one sentence explanation as to how they could elude them for so long. But I will say that there are two things about this illusion or the evasiveness that I find very interesting. Number one, Ricky is on the run, and I mean this literally, on the run for 6 months, yet he doesn't appear to lose a lot of weight. Now remember, Ricky is a heavy set boy. Very heavy set. And I'm seriously doubt that he's getting, you know, 3,000 calories worth of food every single day. You know what I mean? This is, and yet, I mean, they say that he looks skinnier, but I don't believe them. But yeah, this is a kid who definitely hasn't seen a lot of weight loss, especially to the extent that 6 months in the wilderness would do with all the exercise and the very light diet that you would have. The kid would be like had lost may at the better part of maybe 40 or 50 pounds after 6 months of that, you know. He'd probably be the size of Sam Neill at that point. But that was my first. What did y'all think about that aspect, or did this even come up?
Didn't even think about it.
I figure he would have started growing facial hair and grown up a couple inches. But
but the second thing that I found myself asking is, okay, so basically you have this SWAT team, and quote unquote, all of the country is looking for you, right?
Yeah.
For about 6 months, how are they funding this manhunt? Because we're not talking about like an FBI sting where they're waiting for phone calls and stuff. No, they have these people going out in the middle of the motherfucking wilderness, basically tracking them. Not once do they use dogs to try to sniff them out. It isn't like they're masking their scent or anything. They're not, they're not using drones or really helicopter footage. They're not using thermal heat signatures. You know, especially in the winter, they would light up like roaming candles.
They do stumble on using fake cell phone towers.
Okay, but that took literally 6 months because they introduced that at the beginning of the manhunt, and it took 6 months before that worked.
They get it set up.
So I don't buy that at all. I mean, that thing has to be close enough that they would pick up that cell tower instead of some other cell tower. Unless they were weeding out like thousands of cell phone signals just to pick up that one.
Well, you don't get the impression there's that many people out there.
But at the same time, though, considering that there's a long distance, either they're moving that thing closer and closer to them, which means that they already knew where they were, or that thing has a very strong signal base so that they can pick up a very long distance.
Or there's more of those things out there.
But that's the thing, though. If they're using more than one, then it kind of defeats the whole purpose, because the whole point is that it it's meant to be a tracker, you know, it tricks the signal
right.
of the cell phone to believe that it's a cell tower. It's you can't actually make phone calls on that.
Yes, you can.
No, you can't.
Because it can, because it relays it the signal after it tells law enforcement that you're what's connected to it. Then it just relays its signal to the real tower.
That's not how it works. And then they didn't say that. Bear in mind that the way that they found them was because the phone was powered on. It wasn't because they used it to make a phone call.
Yeah. Because I also got the impression they were doing some social media stuff out there too, but
I don't know if that cell phone would have social media.
Yeah. Hey, you could do weird stuff Twitter on a basic phone. So
I don't know about that. But what about you, Chris? What do you take about the way the manhunt was operated?
I honestly didn't think much about it, so I mean, it didn't really bother me. I mean, it's kind of questions are coming up now that you bring it up, but I don't know.
Well, I think for me, I'm able to kind of accept this on the same terms as a young adult novel. You know, the whole point of this is not to be realistic, but to set up a dynamic, you know, a foil for our characters. The whole point of the manhunt isn't so much to be a realistic take on what a real manhunt would be. The whole point is that there is a force that is keeping our characters from going into the real world. And they can't stay in one spot for too long or else they'll be picked up. It's a motivator for the characters, right?
Yeah.
So as a young adult novel element, it's a metaphor. It's metaphorical more than it is literal. Or at least that's kind of where I take on that. But is that how you're seeing it, Ken? Or do you see it as more realistic?
Kind of a mix of realism and seeing. Because I could almost see, hey, we have an idea to do this. Okay, the same bureaucracy that's so inept at everything else.
I would hate for them to
it's going to take you 6 months to get in a position.
I would hate for them to have to explain why taxes are going up for all of these New Zealanders simply so that they can hunt down one older man and a younger boy. You know, at some point,
you just keep putting it in the press as, oh no, he's a danger to society because he kidnapped this boy.
Yeah, but we're talking about easily hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to hunt these two down.
And then you can also call it a training exercise.
Well, if it's a training exercise, they need more training. I mean, that's... Yeah.
Continuous training exercise.
Like, half the time, I don't even think that they're actually looking for them. I think they're just kind of like Keystone Cops. I mean, at one particular point, they're literally just hiding behind a tree, and they go right by.
Well, that's the same shot from The Hobbit, from Fellowship of the Ring. So,
not
let's
really.
Hide under the tree. Yeah.
Well, that's under a tree. No, this is behind a tree, and you don't have any of the callbacks to that scene. No, I just got the sense that these idiot cops, you know, couldn't tell their ass from a Black Widow. But anyway, so let's talk about the two other characters that kind of are kind of important to the story itself, which is Kahu and her father, TK. You know, what do we make of this happens in the middle of the film. You know, they found the paralyzed ranger and Ricky goes off to find help from another bushman. Instead, he finds pretty cute, you know, preteen or teenage girl on a horse.
Well, about the same age and, like, no. And he's almost smitten.
But is he, though? Because
I think he is.
Because the
His facial expression says so.
I mean, the problem is that, at some points, he's smitten by her. Other times, there's kind of a familial element. I mean, eventually, he goes to live with her and her father and assumedly her mother, who's working at the store while her dad's watching the game. and posting on Instagram.
Yeah.
It's a full-time job, man.
And knows that, yeah. And knows, hey, it's you, the Renegade.
Selfie time. Yeah. I have to admit, I love the selfies. I thought that was like, yeah. Now you kidnap me.
Yeah. And Wookiee's the only one going, can we get back to the problem of the ranger that could be dead by now?
But that's the thing is, like, you know, he gets a sausage, he gets a song, and I love how he explains it to Heck, you know, later on. Like, it was a refreshing, it's like, was it a refreshing nap? It was a refreshing sausage. Yeah, I thought that they kind of pulled it. I love the fact that it's a smash cut. After, you know, he kind of dozes off while she's playing guitar, the next scene is her basically throwing him off her horse.
Yeah.
You know? I thought that was kind of a very interesting... He does a lot of these smash cuts, though, throughout the film. Like, things will just kind of happen, and we don't know exactly how we got to that point, but they happen, right? I mean, look at Bella's death. You know, he walks, he hears Heck screaming. We see a moment where she's on the ground, his head is, you know, his head is on her crying. Next scene, funeral. And then we see Ricky and Heck in the first row. At that point, we understand what's happened. But we don't know exactly how she died, just the fact that she died. And then next scene after that is when Heck is making Ricky read the note about him being taken back to child services. You know, it just moves that quickly from one thing to the next to the next. And we have that throughout the film. Like, they run back into the hunters again. We don't exactly know how they ran into him, but they run into him. It's like, you know, one moment they're there, one moment they're not there, and then one moment they're right back. Did you find that a little jarring, or did it make sense in the way that this film was presented?
It makes sense in a number of ways, between the way it's presented and also the environment they're in. If there's not many people, you're going to run into the same people.
Chris?
I mean, I think it might be a little jarring at first, but as you watch the movie, it gets easier to process and you get used to it. You know, in the second half of the movie.
Well, was this one of your problems with the film the first time you saw it?
No, not really. My issue was I didn't find it funny the first time. I didn't find it... Everybody was talking about how great it was, and I was like, it was okay. My first time, that's how I felt. Yeah. Second time, it seemed to all come together for some reason, so...
I get you.
Yeah.
But by the time we get to Psycho Sam, though, we got ourselves a comedy here. Come on.
Yes.
Psycho Sam is easily the funniest thing about this movie. Right? Mm. I mean, come on. We have ourselves a full-on conspiracy theorist in the middle of the woods. Like, you know.
Half man, half bush. Yeah.
You know, I love the Ricky moment where it's like, I don't know why they call him Psycho Sam. And then he puts the strainers on their heads. Like, no, I do. It's like, I don't know, this character is fun. I will say that this is the most blatantly comedic role in the film, right? It's like, there's nothing about this character that's anywhere nuanced. He is a complete caricature, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, though, could you have yourself a nuanced conspiracy theorist in a movie like this? Is there any way that you could have a conspiracy theorist that, you know, was a little bit more grounded, a little bit more believable?
No. Not out in the wilderness like this. But this screams, we need woohoo, government mind control rays are going to try and take me over. Ah, that's why I'm in the forest.
I have to admit, the whole getting, after Ricky finds out that the cops are surrounding the place, that whole getting to the escape was hilarious. It's like, well, we'll need a jetpack. You have a jetpack? No. It's like, what else can we do? We could use this. We could use the escape tunnel to get past the.
Yeah.
Wait, I haven't built it yet. Damn it! Yeah. You know, and it just builds from there, and then of course we get the truck. And what did you think about this chase scene?
Brilliant.
I mean, I don't know what to make of this chase. It's like, I mean, to me, it's like you have helicopters that won't get out in front. It's like they're all chasing them. I do love the all terrain the all terrain carrier that that Paula and Andy are in. Paula's in like the full metal helmet, right?
She's like a bad general on a tank going, go get him!
Like, honestly, though, it really needed to be a tank. Let's be honest here.
Yeah.
To make this scene work, it had to have been a tank. You know, treads and all. That would have made that scene just stick out. Because we could see her in a tank, right? We could definitely see her trying to play tank commander.
She could see herself. I don't think anybody that would issue her a tank would issue her a tank.
Well, considering they made her the face of the manhunt, right? We see her on the evening news where she literally scares the shit out of the reporters with how she talks about Ricky. Like, they're wanting her to say nice things about Ricky. Oh, no, Ricky's horrible, you know? Like, everything that she said to Bella, she says again to the news reporters. And
which makes you wonder what's worth rescuing him if he's so bad.
Well, the thing is that it isn't to her. It's not about rescuing him. It's about putting these two in their place. And she expects everyone to side with her on this. You know, they're not out to save a possible child victim. You know, to her, it's, you know, these creatures need to be put, you know, in a hole. And like, to me, that was the problem I had with the Terminator scene, because Paula basically is offering Ricky a chance to come in with the allure of, if you say that Heck had sexually molested you, then you'll won't see juvenile hall. To me, does that sound right? Does that part of this scene feel like it works in regards to what these characters? Because she really doesn't. She doesn't seem like the type that would use a lie to get it. Yet I don't believe for a second that she would take that off the table. You know, she hates Ricky to an extent, right? In fact, I would say that she hates Ricky more than she hates Heck. I think she's annoyed by Heck because Heck is keeping her from taking Ricky. I think that's her biggest problem with him. Ricky, she just doesn't like. Is that what you get? Do you get that, or do you think I'm off on this?
He hates everyone. But
it's not about like liking him or getting along with him or whatever. Yeah. I think it's... I always took it as her saving face more than anything. She put them into this home that now doesn't have a motherly figure or a woman in the house, and she's trying to pull him out, and now he's faked his death. She's off running around with some fucking guy they're saying is molesting him, you know? So she wants to pull him out because she basically caused all this by putting him there.
But why would she even bring up juvenile hall? Why was she, you know, she's promising that he won't see juvenile hall if he says that Heck molested him, which means that juvenile hall was definitely on the table, that was a place that she would send him. All right. So that particular point, you know, say what you will about what Ricky has done, do we believe that this is a kid that deserves juvenile hall? I mean, hell, even the whole graffiti thing that we're talking about. Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's bad, but nothing that we saw him do in the montage is worth, you know, years in jail for. I mean, it's petty ante and it's juvenile, absolutely, but not criminal or not grossly criminal.
Well, when Ricky brings it up, he makes it sound like he's already gone to every home they want to put him in. So juvenile hall or whatever is the only option because he's been to every home that they have available. So there's nowhere else left for him to go.
But even...
Which in my opinion, is kind of BS that they're like, we got to send him to juvie because of what happened. Well, what happened with
the other households?
Bella's death was not his fault at all. There was no reason to pull him out and say, well, you got to go to juvie because...
Well, no, it's because...
It's like, no.
It's because they don't trust Heck. They released Ricky to Bella. Bella was the guardian, not Heck. Heck was just kind of the tag-along. Bella is dead. Heck doesn't have custody. And nor does Heck want custody, as we know.
But he shouldn't go to juvie because of that.
But at the same time, though, Paula is using that as leverage. So either she intends to send him to juvie because she has nowhere else for him, which is a dick move, or she's lying about using juvie in order to get him to do what she wants, which makes her a douche. There's no way around it. This is a douche move either way.
She was a douche from the start, though, so it fits. Yeah. You know?
So I guess for me, though, I don't know. To me, when we get to this particular finale, the fact that she wins, right?
Yeah.
Because she gets what she wants. She captures Ricky. She captures Heck. Heck goes to jail. Ricky, which, you know, like I mentioned before, you know, the girl of his dreams and her dad practically adopt him. Which, of course, it doesn't help that TK basically, you know, put him all over Twitter with, what, thousands of likes for the photo shoot? So, obviously, I have a feeling if that didn't happen, he would be in juvie. If there weren't these photos and the fact that the New Zealand government didn't decide to arrest him and put him in jail for aiding and abetting a known fugitive, you know, I would assume that if someone had taken photos of Chavo, put them all over Facebook when he was on the run, that they would have been as lenient on him. You know what I'm saying? But yeah, I put Chavo in here. I had to. All right. But so, what did we think about the finale, the epilogue of this, of the way that the movie kind of finds its conclusion?
One of my favorites, though, is just Andy looking over at Paula and basically telling her to go yourself. Yeah, when it's all said and done, okay, you won.
Yeah, but
drop it.
Yeah, the thing I like over. Is that the fact that she firmly believes that she's law enforcement. I mean, she's giving Miranda rights to a New Zealand citizen where there is no Miranda.
And,
you know, like I said, she's gone full on Tommy Lee Jones at this point. She's. You know, and to have Andy ultimately say, look, you have no police powers, so go suck a duck.
You've gone insane, and I'm going to tell somebody, so.
that was very rewarding that when Andy did that. Although I don't know why on earth, you know, any SWAT team would ever take her orders, you know, or listen to her berate them like she does in several scenes, right? I mean, it's
because they don't have permission to just shoot her. So,
so you do what she says?
It's just for comedic effect.
She's probably ordering them to do exactly what they would be doing anyway.
That too, yeah.
If they're gonna follow through with their own orders, they know what they're doing. She's shouting out, "Do this, do that." It's like, bitch, that's what we were gonna do. That's what we're already set up to do.
Except give her a gun. They don't do that. She's yelling for a gun.
Yeah.
They don't give her a gun, do they?
Nope.
Yeah, nope. I didn't think so. Okay.
No. Yeah, she orders a gun, but no one will give her a gun. And I also love wonder the fact why. That Andy's the one who saves Heck. You know, the hunters had been involved in the chase, and one of the hunters gets a bead on Heck. He was going to shoot him, and Andy saves his life. Now, unfortunately, Andy didn't stop the gun from firing, which scares Ricky, and he accidentally shoots Heck in the ass.
Yes, yeah.
Which, did anyone else have a problem with the fact that even though Heck had got a bullet in the ass, they still sat him in the squad car with no medical treatment?
It's fine.
But he's still bleeding on their seats.
I mean... That's the main concern. He's bleeding on the seat, not...
They were red to begin with. I don't know what you're talking about. Oh, man. But what did you take? I mean, I will say another problem that I had with the movie was the moment when Ricky screams out that Heck had molested him. That seemed like really low. That was out of all of the shitty things that the two characters might have done to one another, that one's the closest to being unforgivable for me. Did y'all have that problem?
No, not really.
So you
I didn't really like, I wasn't, it was a dick move. I mean, I'll say that, but I mean, by that point, Heck is already like, we're done, I'm an old man, my fucking body's falling apart, and Ricky basically had the mindset of, if you're not going to be with me, then fuck you, you know.
You're against me.
So. Yeah. So he's going to do whatever he can to fuck it up for him, make it worse. Because in his eyes, he already fucked over Ricky, so.
I don't know. But what about you, Kent? What do you take from this?
Just the whole end scene or just the betrayal thing?
Well, do you see this as being betrayal? Or do you see, you know, or is Ricky justified in his belief that Heck betrayed him by allowing himself to be arrested by the cops?
Oh, yeah, because he still thinks, in his limited thing, he still thinks his way out, even though there's no way out. Right now, they're surrounded.
They're not
going anywhere.
At this particular point, Ricky is willing to go in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
You know, he's still going off of that romantic...
Yeah, but Heck knows he's got a... Ricky has a life ahead of him. He can get over this. It's an end. And, yeah, I see Ricky thinking it's a betrayal. But Heck knows what's right for him, and that's just a surrender. If anybody would want to go out in the blaze, it would be Heck. Because he's close to the end of his life anyway. Why not?
But Heck doesn't have suicidal tendencies. Right. It wasn't like he was going out to the bush to begin with in order to kill himself. He wanted to just get out to the bush so that he could think. You get the sense that this is a guy who enjoys solitary confinement. He relishes quiet and reflection.
Yeah.
I think that the reason why he is okay with this little kid coming along with him is because this kid is kind of in the same jam that he was. You know, as we found out, Heck had gone to prison as a young man. He has had a rough life. He was very broken and damaged, and Bella saved him. And in a way, he sees that in this little boy. And the fact that Bella saw the same thing in him was kind of another justifier for him to take this kid under the wing. But ultimately, he's a man of quiet. As we see, he doesn't actively talk unless it's absolutely important, right?
Yeah.
I mean, hell, even at his, when he's, when after he throws out the ashes of Bella in the waterfall, you know, does he go into a monologue about, you know, about everything? He says, what, like 10 lines or, you know, like 10 words, 3 sentences? You know, he doesn't make a big deal out of this. He's a very insular guy. Do you get that, or are you getting something else?
No, he's the quiet type, mostly. So.
So what do you make of this ending? Of the you know, after Heck comes out of prison for about a year. I think that he was in jail for a year.
I think it was too, yeah.
So he comes out, and he's greeted by, you know, he's greeted by Ricky, and he is basically given an opportunity to reignite that friendship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this isn't a friendship that he was interested in going back to. The fact that Ricky doesn't actually try to engage with him while he was in prison, and we get the sense that he could have at any point. He decided to wait until he got out to throw this on him, right?
Or maybe he couldn't find it.
But yet he was right there when, you know.
Well, it could have. We don't know what the prison rules are. I mean, would the accused be allowed? Would the accuser be allowed to visit him in jail anyway?
Hmm. Well, he didn't accuse him. I understand he went to jail for evading the police.
Okay. Well, they're, who knows?
Or I guess you could say kidnapping of a minor, which I seriously doubt is a one-year offense, although I don't know New Zealand law. For all I know, kidnapping of that extent. And I guess maybe they took circumstances in regards to his and his sentencing. Well,
the whole weird truth could have come out during his trial anyway, and probably did. Well, actually, we see parts of the trial, and that judge was probably able to go, no.
This whole situation was fucked up.
I'll give a year for running and causing a manhunt, and is there any apology?
I doubt it. She's probably enjoying her book circuit, you know, about the manhunt.
Because, you know, once you judge analyzes it, it's probably more, you know, if we had just let him go, we would have just reintegrated anyway.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But what do you think about Ricky and Heck, or that Heck accepts the title of uncle from Ricky, and that they decide to go on another adventure together, this time without the law hunting them?
Yeah. Hopefully, Ricky will just tell everyone he's staying with, yeah, we're going out to the wilderness again, don't worry.
Well, no, they made it very clear that that TK seems to be pretty cool with him hooking back up with Heck. Although, considering, I don't know, I seriously doubt that Child Services would let TK adopt Ricky.
Oh, you mean after the selfie incidents?
Yeah. Seriously doubt it.
Well, but he's burned through everybody else, so.
I don't know. Maybe they are that desperate, but.
Yeah. Actually, what was TK's wife's job again?
She was a store clerk.
Oh, that was it? Okay.
Yeah, she was working, she works nights at the store.
Okay. I was like, maybe she's a judge. No.
No, we never see her.
Yeah.
You know, it might be that she's been working at the store 24 hours a day for how many years, if you know what I mean.
Mm.
You know, went out for cigarettes and just seemed to got lost.
Yeah.
Just saying. Although, I have to admit, though, in this movie, my all-time favorite line in this movie is that, we have a reward for them dead or alive.
Yeah.
I mean, alive.
Alive, yeah. That was almost my intro. But, yeah, that was...
But y'all have another favorite line from this? This movie's got a lot of great lines, I'll be honest here.
It does, yeah.
But that was definitely my favorite.
Not overpowering, but yes.
I like the line. It's also an Andy line. When you first see Heck, oh, look, he's giving a pig a piggyback.
That's
a good line.
All right. So any last words before we get into Geek Sheet?
Ooh.
I had one, but it kind of spoils one of the Geek Sheet things.
Oh, go ahead anyway.
All right, well, let's Ricky... start with the Geek Sheet. And Chris, why don't you start us off?
Ricky Baker's going to be in Deadpool 2, man.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Woo! That's fucking awesome. That's it.
My geek sheet.
That's
That's yours. Okay.
Is it just me, or does the kid who play Ricky kind of look like Ned from Spider-Man? Just a little bit. Just a little bit.
Not. It's stretching it.
Maybe.
Of course, continuing the sheet, Sam Neill. Ooh.
Well, we talked about him earlier this year.
So. Yeah, Jurassic Park, so.
And I think I mentioned a few other of his other...
You mentioned Event Horizon. Mm-hmm. Rachel House is in for Ragnarok. I don't know in what role, but she's listed as being in it. And she was in Moana, so...
Well, she was Grandma in Moana.
Oh, she's Grandma? Okay.
Oh, nice.
Okay. And we have to just go on. Rhys Darby, my favorite crazy...
He's Psycho Sam?
Sam, yes. Because he's in What We Do in the Shadows. He's also in Yes Man, Jim Carrey. I didn't know. Another reason for me to actually get around to start watching Voltron.
Oh, the new one?
I will say that Rhys Darby, for some reason, I thought it was Martin Freeman for a little bit. Come on.
No.
He does look a little bit like Martin Freeman.
And this is where I say I miss At Mid, because he was on so many episodes.
Well, he is a stand-up comedian.
Yes, that's, I mean, that's his main thing, is stand-up, but wow, he's really good.
And he was the lawyer Murray in Flight of the Conchords.
Okay.
So, yes.
And, of course, our director, actor, minister. So, also starring in and directing What We Do in the Shadows and, you know, doing this little film for some company called Thor Ragnarok this weekend. So, yeah, he's kind of knows what he's doing. So kind of a smallish geek sheet, but still impactful.
Alright, so at this time, are we ready to call it?
Okay, this should be interesting. But yeah, unless you got any, Chris.
Oh, no, I'm good.
Okay.
Alright. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on Hunt for the Wilder People? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris!
If you would have asked me the first time I watched it, I probably would have said maybe, but like, I had a really good time watching it the second time when I watched it this time, and it's just, I thought it was really funny. I loved the movie. I don't know if I'd say it's as good as What We Do in the Shadows, but it's close. So it's a definite pass for me.
Kent.
Yeah, it's a fun, quirky film, not particularly realistic at times, but it doesn't need that. It doesn't need to quite be as realistic. It can take liberties with things from time to time, but yeah, I found it enjoyable and tried to get a second viewing in tonight. Didn't quite have the time for it. Did try and listen with the director's commentary, which is funny, so I'm giving it a pass. Also, recommend just commentary. Do both.
And as for me, as I mentioned before, I wasn't the most responsive person to What We Do in the Shadows.
Shame.
But I will say, though, that when it comes to Hunt for the Wilder People, I adore this movie. It's flawed, definitely flawed. But the thing is that its heart is in its right place. And if you look at it from the same impression as, like, reading a young adult fiction novel, it definitely has that vibe. It definitely has those kind of broad areas of character development and storytelling. And to me, that's perfectly fine for this type of movie. It's kind of whimsical in the sense of a Wes Anderson movie without all the kitsch. It has a sense of a place and setting and environment, and it sets up kind of a fun romp, giving it some stakes, but at the same time not making it too dire, too depressing. And to me, that was the thing that I think was missing from What We Do in the Shadows, was a sense of understanding itself and creating an atmosphere that didn't feel like it was all over the place. Not to mention that the music in this movie is really good. And Taika Waititi definitely has a sense of wonder in his movies that is growing. And I love seeing that develop. And I can't wait to see what he does next. Not just the Thor movie, but the movies that I'm expecting for him to do in the future. And I'm talking about not the super big budget movies, but the smaller ones. If he does decide to do What We Do in the Shadows 2, which I think
just announced We're Wolves. Mm-hmm. It's just announced.
We Are Wolves?
Yes.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, yeah. I will definitely be interested in seeing how he does that and how it, especially if it is a direct sequel to What We Do in the Shadows, if he was able to learn from everything and to do something better than he did in the first one. Again, I know that I'm in the minority when it comes to that, but I honestly still think that we haven't seen the best of what Taika Waititi has done. It has to offer. And I want to see what he does next. So, yes, I'm giving this a pass. Strongly recommend that you see it, even with all of its flaws. But I do know that we're just getting into November, and we got some pretty heavy movies and a few fun ones at that we still have to get to through the next couple of months. But, Kent, what do we have up next week?
We're going to go back to the
70s.
Late 70s.
Get your bell bottoms, your discotheque, and your porn.
Ooh.
Or Because Boogie Through the Nights, Boogie Nights, your guide to late 70s.
Finally, we're getting to Paul Thomas Anderson. And just and just before he has another big budget movie coming out later on, which I have to admit I'm really excited about, but we'll have to talk about that at a later time. But at this point, if you have anything to say about our conversation about this film or any of the other films that we've talked about, you can hit us up on the Facebook feed or go on to Twitter at Arthouse Legends or send us an email, arthouselegends@gmail.com. And while you're at it, if you go on to iTunes and give us a 5-star review, that'll help us grow this channel out and get more people to listen, or just kind of bring it up in casual conversation. That works perfectly fine as well. But gentlemen,
randomly mentioned in the podcast to people on Facebook who have talked about one of our movies we've done in the past. So that happened to me this week. So
very nice.
Yeah.
But gentlemen, I thank you for joining me for this episode and for all the episodes that are yet to come. But at this point, any last words?
Being Caucasian isn't as bad as it sounds.
Oh boy. You want some privilege with that?
Yeah. Caucasian? You're clearly white.
Can't, or is that what your last words?
Yeah.
Alright. This is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
This is Chris.
And Finn.